I remember that the ground was soft. It had been raining for what felt like weeks. It was November 15th, and I think the only reason I remember this is because it's my friend's birthday. It's a strange little reminder I've never had the heart to tell her about. I wish it were the only one. I just kept thinking, if only I was bigger, stronger, louder. And then I tried to figure out where the night had gone wrong, what error led to this. And then I just tried to pretend it was consensual. I tried to enjoy it, which is disgusting. Which was disgusting. I think I was so busy hating myself that I didn't have room to hate him. The next day, I stood in the shower and just sobbed. I just endlessly sobbed. I'd never felt so dirty, but I didn't want to touch myself. I didn't want to touch my own body. I didn't want to be touched. And in that moment, in the shower, I decided that would be my time to feel it. To feel bad for myself. My statute of limitations would be 40 minutes of crying in the shower. I became strong not despite the pain, but in spite of the pain. Some sort of optical illusion that somehow bleeds artifact into artifice. I became strong because I thought that was the remedy to feeling weak. I only told two people. Maybe had I only told one, things could have been different. But I told two. I told them both as though I was talking about someone else. Even now, I tell people like I'm talking about someone else. I've always been fantastic at disassociating myself from my own hardships. This would make me an expert. The first person I told listened and loved, probably bewildered by my nonchalant narration. All the same, she listened and she loved. When I told the second person, he asked if I was sure. Then he told me that he'd met the guy once and he seemed like a nice guy. By now we all know this narrative well enough that I won't go into how it made me feel or how it made me afraid to speak up or against my attacker. And this isn't an indictment of the person who doubted. Prior to my attack, and even after, I've doubted others. I've learned since that it's so much easier to doubt than to accept that we live in a world where this happens. Where this happens so often that we know people, people, plural, who have been raped. But it does. And we do. On average, just in the United States alone, 37 people are raped every hour. Which means by the time you're done listening to this, about 27 people will have been raped. Odds are, two people are being raped right now, in this very second. I understand that it's easier to doubt than accept that. That doubt is a luxury I wish I still had. When something like this happens to you, it never fully goes away. Over time, it will start to get smaller and smaller, but it's always there, and you'll find it in the most unlikely of places. It'll creep up when you least expect it, and you won't ever fully be able to make people understand it. It is uniquely yours to do what you can with. I went about my life a little less myself, a stronger facade. I didn't want to feel it, so I stopped feeling altogether. In hindsight, I suppose there were signs. I started drinking more and more. I recoiled whenever people touched me. I stopped making new friends. Other than that, though, it was like nothing had ever happened. I buried it. And then I got pneumonia. It was a year and a week later, and I knew almost immediately. Healthy 26-year-olds don't get pneumonia. I remember that before getting tested, I told the doctor that I thought I was HIV positive. It was in an effort to make it easier on her. So when she did in fact have to tell me, she'd know it wouldn't be a complete surprise. And that's how I found out. A confirmation, not a conversation. I cannot even imagine having to surprise someone with that kind of news. Here's what happens when you find out you have HIV. Someone you don't even know tells you in what is literally a clinically sterile and cold room. And then you go home. The strange thing that almost all of us will experience at one point or another is the feeling you have when something happens to you that changes your entire world. And then you have to go out into the world with it. And everyone around you is living their everyday lives, and it feels so isolating. It feels like an insult. Step one is leaving the clinic and walking out into the world and trying to just get home and exist. Somehow all simultaneously. I locked myself in my room that night and drank an entire bottle of wine. Step two is waking up. It's your first day waking up HIV positive. It's your first day as a different person. It's the first day you have to attempt to accept your new reality. I sat quietly in my room trying to come up with a plan. I'm a planner. It's how I take control of situations. It makes me feel safe. I was going to somehow plan myself around this new reality. I didn't want to tell people. Not anyone. Not at all. I wanted to bury it, too. It was the first of many times I realized that being HIV positive would deny me autonomy. I had to tell people. At the very least, three. Step three is calling everyone you've been sexually active with since the night you got raped. Your ex-boyfriend, the surgeon for whom you were a six-month rebound, the anal retentive jerk you dated and subsequently dumped when you found out he was cheating on you, the acquaintance who you got drunk and ended up in bed with. The thing about all these calls you dread making is your fear that the way in which some piece of shit ruined your life may be the way in which you ruin their lives. Maybe the way in which they've since ruined someone else's life. I always practiced safe sex, but guilt and fear are everywhere. Guilt and fear were everywhere. My roommate and I went to brunch, and I decided to rip off the Band-Aid. And as I watched her cry over pancakes, I realized that she was the first person, of many, to cry over it, even before me. The next day, I told another friend in the soup aisle of a gourmet grocery store, and I watched her cry over it. And still, I would not. It would be years. It was in telling these two friends that I realized I could no longer ignore what happened to me. For the first time in over a year, I had to say it aloud again, and I found myself saying it aloud a lot. But the story became a byline. I'm HIV positive. I contracted it last year when I was sexually assaulted. It's no big deal. I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm fine. I wasn't fine. I was drinking an entire bottle of wine almost every single night. I'd been fired from my job after I told my boss. She was worried I wouldn't be able to manage all of her accounts anymore, that I was distracted. It was true, but probably also illegal or at the very least socially irresponsible. Nevertheless, I found myself with even more time on my hands, so each night I would drink myself to sleep. And each day I'd sleep through the afternoon until it was time to do it all over again. I did my best to make sure no one worried about me. I continued to reassure my friends that everything was fine. These things just happen. It is what it is. But beneath all the reassurance, I was pretty sure I wanted to die. It wasn't so much the HIV, but how I contracted it. It had bubbled back to the surface. It had filled me with hate. So much unwavering hate. The only thing that kept me sane was writing. I had been an active blogger for close to a decade and just wrote through it all. I tried to decipher exactly how I felt, how to feel about this thing that was so much bigger than me, by endlessly writing about it. I knew that I wanted to die and eventually figured that I'd probably just drink myself to death. And that would be easier for others to accept than suicide. So I just kept drinking and writing, hoping that eventually one or the other would lead me out of it. Instead, it was an email from South Korea. My name is Robert. You don't know me, but I've been reading your blog for the last 6 years. You've made me smile, you've made me laugh, you've made me cry. You've become someone I want to know. I too used to live in New Orleans and in Portland. Now I live in Korea, and I'm planning a trip to Thailand and Cambodia. And I want to fly you out to join me. Please don't take this the wrong way. This is not about sex or seduction. I live in Asia. If I really wanted sex that bad, I could find it easily here for much cheaper than a plane ticket across the world. I just genuinely want to know you. It was the most insane email I'd ever received. And there was no way in hell I was going to let a complete stranger fly me to Asia. The email instantaneously became an anecdote I couldn't wait to share. My roommate always had these over-exaggerated responses to everything. I hated it most of the time. Now it's one of the things I miss the most about her. It's funny how that's generally the rule. The things you hate most about people are the things you miss the most when they're no longer in your life. It's something I try to carry with me for the moments when my loved ones' weird tics drive me crazy. And that day, to that email, I knew her over-exaggerated response would be perfect. And it was. Until she decided to look Robert up on Facebook. A normal response, one almost out of habit nowadays, that changed my life forever. Again. The universe has a funny way of conspiring to give you what you need. It turns out, Robert had already been an anecdote in our house. My roommate used to talk endlessly about this beautiful boy she had a crush on when she lived in Philadelphia, who she'd seen around Portland from time to time, but couldn't reconnect with. She called him Beauty Boy. It turns out, unbeknownst to all of us, Robert was Beauty Boy. She said the trip would probably never happen, but that Robert was worth knowing. Unbelievably, over the next week, more and more connections to Robert were made. Our next-door neighbor's boyfriend used to date him. A good friend of mine used to hang out in a coffee shop he owned in New Orleans. And then my best friend went to a wedding in London where she met Robert's roommate. And so I told him I would go, never even expecting the tickets to arrive. But it gave me something to hope for. And through insomnia and nightly emails, Robert and I became good friends. He became a confidant. He started sending me little trinkets from Korea. He kept me company when I was the loneliest I'd ever been. He motivated me to keep writing. He told me all about all the places we'd go and the things we'd see. That the world was so much bigger than the place I had found myself trapped in. That hope, it turned out, was merely a band-aid. My anger was unbearable for everyone. My drinking became exhausting for everyone. I started lashing out, I took for granted how hard the people around me were fighting to protect me. I never even saw it. All I saw was red. I lost a lot of friends that year. I made a lot of bad decisions that year. I hurt a lot of people who loved me that year. And I never even saw it. I was in too deep. I was consumed in myself, self-destructively. I think it's fair to say there's no proper way to handle being raped. There's no proper way to handle contracting HIV. I do know I didn't handle it well, but I handled it the best I could for the place I was in life. That's an inexcusable truth that I use now to empathize with others. We do the best we can. I landed in Seoul on a Thursday afternoon. Robert was everything that people had made him out to be. He was genuine, he was honest, he was kind, he was wild. He'd also flown in one of his best friends, Monique, to join us, which eased any discomfort I might have otherwise felt about the trip. That first night, we bought a bottle of wine from a man on a rickshaw in a park, and we ended up in a bar in a cave hidden away on the fourth floor of some unassuming office building. It was so, so messy. I made out with two contestants of America's Next Top Model, met a bunch of Katrina refugees, and convinced a girl I was the head beaver keeper at the Portland Zoo. Spent the majority of the night slurring out facts about beavers, in between doing shots of soju. I threw up on Seoul Tower the next morning, and then hopped on a plane for Bangkok. We spent a week hopping around Thailand, eating street food, getting $9 massages, drinking wide-eyed on Cowboy Road, and quietly appreciating the rustic villages in the north. It was on our last day in Chiang Mai when we debated over and eventually made a fateful decision. We had tickets back to Bangkok, where we were scheduled to take an 8-hour bus to the Cambodian border, but we'd since found $60 tickets to fly directly into Siem Reap, our intended destination. Ultimately, we opted to stick to the original plan. And that night, we flew to Bangkok and boarded a bus early the next morning. We arrived at the border well past sunset. The stars outshone the village lights of Oranyaprath at Thailand. We rode the last bus in and had 10 minutes to cross the Thai border, walk about 300 yards past a casino, and into and through the Cambodian border. Once we left Thailand, we realized we were in danger of being stuck overnight in what was essentially a lawless land, the size of a football field. We ran for the border as fast as we could as a pack of children descended upon us, circling us as we ran, begging us for money. It was heartbreaking. And it wasn't until we made it into the Cambodian customs building that we realized they'd cut our bags open and stolen multiple cameras and well over $400 in cash. We were some of the last people to cross into Phoi Phet that night. To get from Phoi Phet to Siem Reap, you have to hire a taxi. It's a 4-hour trek over what is essentially a 40-mile dirt road. A dirt road they referred to as the highway. We got into the very last cab with a cabbie who spoke no English and charged us double the going rate. If you'd seen Phoi Phet, you'd understand our rush to get out of it. Our taxi wouldn't open the trunk of the car for us, so we had to sit with our backpacks over our knees, and we settled in for the long midnight ride. We hadn't been on the highway for more than 30 minutes when he pulled off into the jungle. He parked in front of a small hut and motioned that he was getting gas. I was sitting in the front passenger seat and could easily see that the gas tank was full. From the doorway of the hut, a man with a gun glared at us. Drugs. The trunk is full of drugs, Robert said, almost to no one at all. We sat there for what felt like hours, but it was probably just a few minutes, and when our driver returned to the car, he casually handed me a brick of cocaine. Then drove out of the jungle and back onto the highway to see him rip. We made three more stops that night, and debated over the static of a Cambodian talk radio whether we'd make it to our destination alive. Spoiler alert, we did. And after being robbed and used as a drug mule upon my first 4 hours in Cambodia, I knew I would hate it there. We spent our first Cambodian morning in a downtown cafe. And in a little less than 2 hours, at least 7 children and amputees begged us for food. We started buying $2 sandwiches just to give away. I'd never seen poverty like that. I've never seen poverty like that. But also, grace. These people begging us for food, they were mostly happy. They talked to us. They smiled at us. They told us how lucky they were. The people begging us for food told us how lucky they were. We spent the majority of our 5 days there traveling from temple to temple and talking to street kids. We bought chicken skewers from a woman whose tongue had been cut off during the Khmer Rouge. We shared lunch with a man who lost all of his limbs after stepping on a landmine. We sobbed over a woman who cradled her dying newborn baby in her arms below a temple. We bought a hamburger for a naked 6-year-old boy who sat alone on a street corner as the sun set behind us. These are the images I will never forget. They don't go away. These are people I think about all the time now. Almost every day. If there was a moment that defined that entire trip, that entire period of my life, it was handing a hamburger to a naked boy and watching him look up from the ground, look me straight in the eye, and smiling. I got back to Portland a few weeks before my 27th birthday. I remember listening over birthday dinner as a friend talked about how the terrible traffic had ruined his day. And I wanted to reach across the table and shake him. Instead, I thought about all the terrible things I'd been through in the preceding year. I thought about how HIV had ruined my life. I thought about being raped. I thought about all the nights I wished I'd just die. And then I thought about that smiling boy. I thought about our places in the worlds in which we occupy. I left Portland 4 months later for San Francisco, but not before returning to Cambodia first. It took me 3 years to see a doctor after that day of confirmation. I was afraid. And I realize as I say this how ridiculous it's going to sound, but that doesn't negate how real the fear was. I was afraid I was going to have to start taking meds. And meds would make everything real. Meds meant I couldn't disassociate myself from it. Meds would be a daily reminder. Once a day, every day. You were raped. You got HIV. For the rest of my life. I got blood draws every 6 weeks. I sat in chairs and sterile rooms watching my poisonous blood travel from my arms through translucent tubes and into little vials, from where it would be tested in labs far away. Those little vials labeled by stickers with a number and maybe even my name. I thought a lot about my place in the world. I thought about my place amongst a million statistics. It's hard not to round yourself down to a number when everything around you is rounded down to any number of things as a means to represent a whole. I've spent so much time trying to reconcile my place in the world. It's nearly impossible to allow yourself to connect to your own hardships when you've seen people who have it so much worse than you do. It's just as hard when you realize you are a fraction of a percent of a greater whole. Because of this, I minimize my feelings. A lot. I still have trouble reconciling. I want to believe it's for the better. Step 4 is moving forward. I started dating again. I learned about rejection in ways I'd never experienced it before. When someone tells you they don't want to be with you because you're HIV positive, it's a kick to the stomach. It takes you back. It takes you back to that place you never wanted to be in the first place. That place where you realize your life has changed forever because someone couldn't take no for an answer. Because you were not bigger, stronger, louder. And it happens over and over and over again. At first. And then you just want the whole world to know everything about you just so you don't have to experience that rejection again. But then, if you're lucky, you meet someone who accepts you for who you are, not what you have. And he makes you go to the doctor, and he talks you through starting meds, and he teaches you that it's okay to feel the things you feel, in spite of everything worse you've seen. And he tells you that it's okay. He tells you that it's okay to feel the things you feel. And it is. Four months into our life on the road, I missed a Cobra payment by 2 days. And for the first time since I'd started meds, I was uninsured. The short end of this is that going off meds for a prolonged period of time will cause the virus to immediately start attacking your white blood cells, which leaves you susceptible to infection and also can lead to drug resistance. The short end of it can become deadly. Fast. By the time I took my last pill, I was on multiple waiting lists for charity prescriptions. HIV meds cost an average of $5,400 a month. $65,000 a year. When you're HIV positive and uninsured, it costs you more than most people make in a year just to stay alive. I called the drug company directly, a company who makes an average annual profit of $26 billion. And they told me they could help me out. They could get me meds the very next day at a discounted charity rate of $4,000. I was off meds for just shy of 6 weeks before we landed in New York and finally got me on Medicaid, a program often scoffed at that saved my life. It's hard not to think of those drug companies and the money they make. I imagine them cashing in big bonus checks because more people contracted HIV this year than last. I think of the value my blood has. It's hard not to think of my blood as blood money. But then I think of the lives saved, and I try to reconcile the two. I still have trouble reconciling. Step 5. Articulate your suffering in a way that emancipates you and empowers others. Living with HIV is easier than getting HIV. Is easier than accepting HIV. Is easier than surviving HIV. And I'm thankful every day for having the opportunities and experiences I've had. I'm thankful that I have options. So many more options than so many other people who live in this statistical bracket with me. Accepting that you were raped is easier than accepting that it wasn't your fault. Is easier than hating the world that lets it happen again and again and again and again and again. Is easier than forgiving. Is easier than saying it out loud. I was raped. 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 And I got HIV. You do not have the luxury of forgetting or getting over either. But now when I find myself lost in it, or angry, or myopic, I think of two smiling eyes on a corner in the night in Cambodia. I usually use this time to thank all the wonderful people who support this podcast on Patreon or through PayPal, but today I want to thank some of the wonderful people mentioned in this podcast. Robert Johnston, Jen Gage, Ina Levin, Sue Tortolani, and Andrew Nino. This story wouldn't exist without any of you. When I talk about this podcast, I find myself saying a lot that every person has a story and every story matters. And while this is a part of mine, we have to remember that so many other people have stories similar to mine who don't have Roberts. Or Andrews, who don't have the options I had. I think the reason I chose to do a story on Austin, Indiana, was that it might help me reconcile my place in the world, and that it might help others who know me, or understand me, or appreciate me, understand my place amongst the people in Austin. And empathize with the strangers they don't even know and probably never will. Next week on Our Americana, we return to Austin, where everyone in the town has a reaction, but very few people have an answer.